only happens every now and
then. Tom. Tom, that's the pledge drive music. The pledge.
We have to get 5,000 subscribers, Bob. It's real important to us.
Tom, the pledge drive is over.
I'm sorry, Bob. Would you say that again?
The pledge drive is over. It was very successful. We made a lot of money, but now it's time to get on with the business of the station. It's time for my program time. Would you just please put on the right music?
I'm sorry, Bob. I guess I just I don't know. I've been.
Yeah. Look, don't worry about it.
Okay, Bob. Hang on just a second.
Ah, there, that's better. Hi, everybody. Bob Claster here, and I'm your host for Funny Stuff, a half-an-hour program presented every week here on KCRW, except when it's preempted. But luckily, we have a schedule that is fairly free from preemptions. We're just going to have one a month for a while, so you can fairly regularly look forward to half-an-hour of comedy here on Friday nights. And as far as tonight's program goes, it is a program of Woody Allen. I know those of you who are regular listeners to the program will recall that last time we met, which was just before the pledge drive, I said that although the program guide said it was a Woody Allen program, it would be a surprise. The surprise is that I lied, and it's going to be a Woody Allen program with different material from the stuff that we did in the last program. So those of you who heard that needn't fear duplication. You have all new stuff. And it's good stuff and well worth hearing. I just thought it'd be simpler. Let's talk a little bit about some of the upcoming programs, because there's a lot to be excited about. First of all, coming up next week in this time slot, we'll be interviewing Tom Lehrer. A very rare interview. He doesn't give very many of them. And we'll be talking to him about a lot of things, mainly how come he doesn't do comedy records anymore. And so that'll be next week, next Friday night at 9:30. And we'll be preempted the following week, which is the 11th. But then on March 18th, we'll be listening to the best of the Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner 2,000-Year-Old Man albums. There are four of those. I'm going to edit all those together into one half-hour hunk for us to enjoy. And then on March 25th, I'll have another exclusive interview with Jonathan and Darlene Edwards. I believe it's the first radio interview they've ever been given. It's probably the first one they've ever been asked for. And I'll be playing a lot of their records. I'm sure a lot of you have never heard of them, but I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We're going to be playing, among other things, their very rare single of the Bee Gees song, Stayin' Alive, which many have said it has to be heard to be relieved. And I'm sure you'll agree when you hear that program on the 25th of March. In April, we're going to have a program of British rarities featuring early work by the Monty Python people and the Beyond the Fringe people, and some wonderful old stuff that's very, very funny and hardly ever heard in this country. And then a program of early improv groups with The Premise and the Second City groups and The Committee. Some very rare stuff there that's also very funny. Alan Arkin and Barbara Harris. Joan Darling, George Siegel, some of the people you'll hear on that program. And then a program of Peter Sellers records that is delightful. And then a Firesign Theater half hour. We're going to play the Nick Danger program for you. And that'll take care of April. So there's a lot to look forward to here on Funny Stuff. But as far as this week goes, let's listen to Woody Allen. What can you say about Woody Allen? Everyone knows who he is. And if you've never heard his stand-up stuff, you're in for a treat. Here it is.
I have never in my life had difficulty with the cops. I had difficulty with the cops. Actually, I didn't have difficulty with the cops. I was once sitting home in my house, and a lot of cars pulled up around the house. They shined in searchlights. And I heard a voice over a loudspeaker say, "We have your house surrounded. This is the New York Public Library." They wanted the books back, you know. And the little librarian was lobbing grenades over the house. But came out with my hands up, you know, kicking the book ahead of me. They took me down to the main branch on Fifth Avenue in New York, and they took away my glasses for a year. And I was thinking, when I lived in my apartment in the brownstone building in New York, we were constantly getting robbed all the time. It was a very big feature of the neighborhood, you know. It was guys would break in and steal, and my apartment was robbed about four times in 2 years. You know, it really got to be a bad thing, and I didn't know what to do about it. So finally I put on my door a little blue and white sticker that said, "We gave." figured that would end it brilliantly, you know, but it didn't, because a man in my building, Mr. Russo, was held up late at night. Two very big guys got him with a bottle and a stick in the lobby, you know, and they wanted all his cash, and Russo, like a jerk, tried to sign for it for tax purposes, whatever it is, you know. They hit him a tremendous shot across the frontal lobe, you know, real smack in the head, and he fell to the lobby in a fetal position, you know. He lay there until his lease ran out, you know. He's never been the same since the smack in the head, you know. He smiles a lot now. He laughs out of context occasionally, you know. He's not as perceptive as the average tree stump, you know. Everybody in the building panicked. They said that I'm small and I should go and build myself up in case I get into trouble, I could defend myself. So I went to Vic Tanny's. This was a long time ago. I went for 3 weeks. And I lifted and I bent and I squatted. Nothing happened to me at all, you know, nothing grew or anything. And I figured it's ridiculous. Why don't I forget about it and give Vic Tanny the cash and ask him if he'll walk me home nights, okay? However, there is a kid in my building, a little odd kid named Leon. And Leon takes karate lessons. And Leon is always walking around with his hand cocked at a right angle like this, you know? And everyone said that I should learn judo because I'd be an animal. But judo to me has always been a thing of the bigger your opponent is, the bigger the beating he's going to give you. You know? It's the way I feel about it, essentially. The Japanese lost the war, I feel. I don't want to get involved, you know. So I lived in fear. And then my good friends told me in the back of Esquire magazine, you can send away for a fountain pen that shoots tear gas. It's a real fountain pen, and it secretes a gaseous billow, you know, a really great pen, $7.50. I send away, comes in the mail 2 weeks later in a plain brown wrapper, you know. I unscrew it, I put in the tear gas cartridges, and I clip it in my breast pocket, you know, and I go out. A long time ago this was, some friends in my neighborhood had a surprise autopsy, and I'm invited for the evening, you know. I'm coming home by myself, 2 o'clock in the morning, and it's pitch black, and I'm all alone, and standing in my lobby is a Neanderthal man. With the eyebrow ridges, you know, and the hairy knuckles like this, you know. He had just learned to walk erect that morning, I think. Came right to my house in search of the secret of fire, you know. A tree swinger in the lobby at 2 o'clock in the morning. A mouth breather looking at me like, you know. I took my watch out and I dangled it in front of him, you know, because they're mollified by shiny objects sometimes. He ate it. It's really under pressure, and I backed off and I pulled out my tear gas pen and I pressed the trigger and some ink trickled on my shirt, you know. I made a mental note to call Esquire and tell them, because I'm standing in the lobby 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, with the product of a broken home, you know. I had a fountain pen in my hand there. I tried writing on him with it, you know. He came for me and he started to tap dance on my windpipe. So very quickly I lapsed into the old Navajo Indian trick of screaming and begging. He started to remove my wisdom teeth, you know. And I'm hitting him and I'm telling him he's the product of an economic squeeze, you know. And I have on my chest the words, do not fold, spindle, or mutilate. And I offered to send him to camp if he wanted, finally. And some cops, about 6 cops came, and they saw what was going on, and they took his side. I get into an amazing amount of physical encounters for someone my size. I really, about 13 weeks ago, I had my shoes shined against my will. Tremendous shoe shine, boy, said to me, I'm shining your shoes. Yes, you are, I said. He did give me an excellent shine on my dad, but they were suede shoes, and I really... I shot a moose once. I was hunting upstate New York, and I shot a moose, and I strap him onto the fender of my car, and I'm driving home along the West Side Highway. But what I didn't realize was that the bullet did not penetrate the moose. It just creased his scalp, knocking him unconscious. And I'm driving through the Holland Tunnel, and the moose woke up. So I'm driving with a live moose on my fender. And the moose is signaling for a turn, you know? And there's a law in New York State against driving with a conscious moose on your fender Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. And I'm very panicky. And then it hits me. Some friends of mine are having a costume party. I'll go. I'll take the moose. I'll ditch him at the party. It wouldn't be my responsibility. So I drive up to the party, and I knock on the door. The moose is next to me. My host comes to the door. I say, hello. You know the Solomons. We enter. The moose mingles. Did very well. Scored. Some guy was trying to sell him insurance for an hour and a half. 12 o'clock comes. They give out prizes for the best costume of the night. First prize goes to the Berkowitzes, a married couple dressed as a moose. The moose comes in second. The moose is furious. He and the Berkowitzes lock antlers in the living room. They knock each other unconscious. Now I figure here's my chance. I grab the moose, strap him to my fender, and shoot back to the woods. But I got the Berkowitzes. So I'm driving along with two Jewish people on my fender. There's a law in New York State. Tuesdays, Thursdays, and especially Saturday. The following morning, the Berkowitzes wake up in the woods in a moose suit. Mr. Berkowitz is shot, stuffed, and mounted at the New York Athletic Club. And the joke is on them because it's restricted. I was kidnapped once. I was standing in front of my schoolyard, and a black sedan pulls up. And two guys get out, and they say to me, do I want to go away with them to a land where everybody is fairies and elves? And I could have all the comic books I want, and chocolate, and wax lips, you know? And I said yes, you know? And I got into the car with them, because I figured, you know, what the hell? I was home that weekend from college anyhow, you know? They drive me off, and they send a ransom note to my parents. And my father has bad reading habits. So he gets into bed at night with the ransom note. And he read half of it, you know. And he got drowsy and fell asleep. Then he lent it out, you know. Meanwhile, they take me to New Jersey, bound and gagged. And my parents finally realize that I'm kidnapped. And they snap into action immediately. They rent out my room. The ransom note says for my father to leave $1,000 in a hollow tree in New Jersey. He has no trouble raising $1,000, but he gets a hernia carrying the hollow tree. The FBI surround the house. Throw the kid out, they say. Give us your guns and come out with your hands up. The kidnappers say, we'll throw the kid out, but let us keep our guns and get to our cars. The FBI says, throw the kid out. We'll let you get to your car, but give us your guns. The kidnappers say, we'll throw the kid out, and let us keep our guns. We don't have to get to our car. The FBI says, keep the kid. The FBI decides to lob in tear gas, but they don't have tear gas. So several of the agents put on the death scene from Camille. Tear-stricken, my abductors give themselves up. They're sentenced to 15 years on a chain gang. And they escape, 12 of them, chained together at the ankle, getting by the guards posing as an immense charm bracelet. talking about this on TV last week. I escape always into a rich fantasy life that comes from an unhappy childhood. My parents did not want me when I was a child. They put a live teddy bear in my crib, you know? I come from a poor family. My father worked at Coney Island. He had a concession on the boardwalk where you knock over milk bottles with baseballs, which I could never do for my entire childhood. There was a tidal wave at Coney Island when I was a child that ripped up the boardwalk and did about $1 million worth of damage, houses and everything. The only thing left standing were those little milk bottles, you know? I would say over-disciplined, which is really humiliating. I had to be home 9:30 prom night. I made a reservation at the Copacabana for 5 o'clock. I took my date and we watched them set up. Now, I was invited when I was a kid, I will never forget this, to Seymour Gutkin's birthday party. And I loathe birthday parties because my mother used to make me wear my cousin's hand-me-downs all the time, you know, and she was not my size, you know, it's really humiliating. And so I wouldn't lose them. My mother would pin my mittens to my sleeves, you know, and that day I had on a short-sleeve shirt and I looked like this, you know, I was strangling. And at that age, I identified with Superman. That was my thing. I felt Superman and I had many traits in common. He used to go into telephone booths and remove his clothing all the time. So did I, you know. And I took my parents' best tablecloth, the Hotel Dixie tablecloth, and I tie it around my neck, you know, a pin there, and it drapes behind me, and I look like Superman, but really good. And I tuck my cake tablecloth in, and I'm ready for action. And I go out to Gutkin's birthday party, and I'm riding the BMT subway. I'm coming into the Avenue J station in Brooklyn, and I look out on the platform, and I see Hermina Jaffe is being molested. Hermina Jaffe, I adored. She was the wildest kid in school. She was 5 years old, but an absolute murderer. She was sexy. She had an overbite, and that killed me, you know? She had the biggest overbite in Brooklyn, you know? She used to eat a piece of toast and finish the outer edge first on. So the train pulls into the platform, and I get out, you know, and the doors open there, and I take my cape out behind me, you know, and I'm really looking like Superman. I was a dashing kid, and she's being annoyed by Guy de Maupassant Rabinowitz. He was the worst kid in the neighborhood. I loathed him. In the early 1940s, in the Roosevelt-Dewey election, his parents voted for Hitler. And I say to him, you know, take your hands off her, Gita. And I pull my cape out, you know. I really look Supermanish. And he says to me, knock off, Four Eyes. I have bad eyesight and I'm sensitive about it. When I take an eye test, the optometrist points to the letters and he calls them out. He says, true or false. And I'm all set to smack him in the mouth, and the doors to the subway close on my cape and the train pulls out. I'm hanging by my neck for 22 blocks, you know, trains are going past me and the third rail is underfoot, and I don't know if you know the New York subway system or not, but that's safer than riding inside the train. I was, as a matter of fact, when I think of it, terrorized as an adolescent. I was not that young when it happened. I was, I guess about 13 or so at the time, I was on my way to an amateur music contest, and my family is musical, you should know that. My father used to play the tuba. As a young man, he tried to play the tuba. He tried to play Flight of the Bumblebee on the tuba. He blew his liver out through the horn, you know? And I'm on the subway with my clarinet, Jerry jazz musician style, unwrapped and everything. And these 12 guys come running through the subway, but really hairy knuckle types, you know, race through. Apparently they had just come from a settlement house, you know, because they were dribbling a social worker as they went through the car, you know? They stopped right over me, you know, because I was conspicuous, because I had just eaten a seafood lunch and I'd forgotten to remove the lobster bib, you know? So I look like a farmer with a fat tie, you know, and Neptune on it. They stand over me and they start cursing and smoking and tearing up seats, you know, and I don't say anything, you know, I just sit there and look down, continue reading Heidi. And all of a sudden, the leader puts his finger under my neck like this and goes, pew. I got up. And he snapped his knee up quickly, and I refused to give him the satisfaction of doubling over. But I did one of the greatest imitations of Lily Pons you've ever heard. I hit an M over high C on the BMZ. Showed up an hour late for the music contest. Came in second, anyhow.
I won.
2 weeks at interfaith camp, where I was sadistically beaten by boys of all races and creeds. I had once a pain in my chest over here. You didn't know it was a musical act. I did. I had a pain in the chestal area. And I was sure it was heartburn, you know, because that time I was married and
my wife was
cooking with her Nazi recipes, you know. Chicken Himmler. I didn't want to pay $25 to have it reaffirmed by some medic that I had heartburn. But I was worried because it was in the chestal area. Then it turns out my friend, Eggs Benedict, has a pain in his chestal area in the same exact spot. And I figured if I could get Eggs to go to the doctor, I could figure out what's wrong with me at no charge. So I con Eggs. And he goes. Turns out he's got heartburn. Cost him $25. And I feel great. Because I figure I beat the medic out of 25 big ones, you know.
I call up Eggs 2 days later.
He died. I check into a hospital immediately. Have a battery of tests run, x-rays. Turns out I got heartburn. Cost me $110. Now I'm furious. I run to Egg's mother. And I say, did he suffer much? And she said, no, it was quick. Car hit him and that was it.
Long time ago, it's a weird story, I was out in Los Angeles. And I was at a party with a very big Hollywood producer. And at that time, they wanted to make an elaborate CinemaScope musical comedy out of the Dewey Decimal System. And they wanted me to work on it. And I go out to the producer's building in downtown Los Angeles, and I walk into his elevator, and there are no people in the elevator, no buttons on the wall or anything. And I hear a voice say, kindly call out your flaws, please. And I look around, and I'm alone. And I panic. You know, in the event of any sort of emergency, I lose control of the major muscles quickly, you know. And I read on the wall that it's a new elevator and it works on a sonic principle. And it's all sound. All I have to do is say what floor I want to go to and it takes me there. So I say 3, please. And the doors close and the elevator starts going up to 3. And on the way up, I began to feel very self-conscious because I talk, I think, with a slight New York accent. And the elevator spoke quite well. And I get out and I'm walking down the hall and I look back and I thought I heard the elevator make a remark. And I turn quickly and the door's closed and the elevator goes down, you know, and I didn't want to get involved at that time with the elevator in Hollywood. But this is the strange part of the story that was the normal part. I have never in my life had good relationships with mechanical objects of any sort, anything that I can't reason with or kiss or fondle. I get into trouble with. I have a clock that runs counterclockwise for some reason, and my toaster pops up my toast and shakes it and burns it, and I hate my shower. If I'm taking a shower and someone in America uses his water, that's it for me, you know. I leap from the tub scalded. I have a tape recorder. I paid $150 for it. And as I talk into it, it goes, I know, I know. About 3 years ago, I couldn't stand it anymore. I was home one night. I called a meeting of my possessions. I got everything I owned into the living room. My toaster, my clock, my blender. They'd never been in the living room before. And I spoke to them. I was really adorable. I opened with a joke. And then I said, I know what's going on, and cut it out. I have a sun lamp, and as I sit under it, it rains on me. And I spoke to each appliance. I was really articulate. And then I put him back, and I felt good. And 2 nights later, I'm watching my portable television set, my little tiny... I'm watching Dr. Joyce Brothers. She's explaining to a Bronx housewife how it was possible for her daughter to have gotten pregnant from joining the Peace Corps. And the set begins to jump up and down, and I go up to it, and I always talk before I hit. And I said, I thought we had discussed this. What's the problem? And the set kept going up and down, so I hit it. And it felt good hitting it. And I beat the hell out of it as well. I was really great. I tore off the antenna. And I felt very virile. And 2 days later, I go to my dentist in New York. I had gone to my dentist, but I had a very deep cavity, and he had sent me to a chiropodist. And I go into a building, Midtown, New York, and I have those elevators. And I'm hip because I was to the coast. And I hear a voice say, kindly call out your floors, please. And I say, 16. And the doors close, and the elevator starts going up to 16. And on the way up, the elevator says to me, are you the guy that hit the television set? I felt like an ass, you know? And it took me up and down fast between floors. And it threw me off in the basement. And it yelled out something that was anti-Semitic. And the upshot of the story is that day, I call my parents. My father was fired. He was technologically unemployed. My father worked for the same firm for 12 years. They fired him. They replaced him with a tiny gadget this big. It does everything that my father does, only it does it much better. The depressing thing is, my mother ran out and bought one.
Some terrific material he recorded back in 1966 and 1965. I think of all the things that he's done, stand-up is really the thing that he was best at, and I'd love to see him go back to that. I know he would look at it as a step backward, but I don't necessarily think it would be. And that'll do it for tonight's episode of Funny Stuff. Let's see, oh yeah, on the Funny Stuff calendar, the comedy calendar, there is, the only thing that I have to recommend this week is The Irrational Enquirer. It's a parody of the National Enquirer, and although it's a cheap shot and fairly obvious, it's very well done, and I think you'll like it. It's at selected newsstands. So that'll do it for this week. Join me again next week with my interview with Tom Lehrer. And don't forget to keep that sense of humor exercised, because you never know when you'll need it. Thanks a lot. Good night, everybody.